Good morning, Grove. I hope you're all well today, are you? You like my shirt? Okay, it's old. I haven't worn it here since I've been here because I thought it may be a little bit too drastic for y'all. So anyway, but today I'm declaring it's officially spring. What do you think, huh? We're moving right through that mud season, right? There's going to be no more winter, no more snow. Spring is here. Come on, church, amen, yeah? There you go. Okay, so I don't want to hear any complaints about it's too hot because it's going to be 70 today, I guess, so That'd be a good thing, wouldn't it? Hey, be turning in your Bibles to the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, right at the beginning of your New Testament. We've been in Romans, and we're taking a three-week break here, and we're going to be talking about the Passion Week as we move to Easter, which is 2 weeks from today, and then we're going to be back into Romans right after Easter on the 28th, and we'll finish out chapters 12 through 16. But as you're turning, I was thinking this last week that we have been inundated here in America with this topic of fake news. You know, years ago, you would have never heard anything like that. Years ago, when somebody, you know, was speaking to a television camera that was being broadcast, we were absolutely sure that it was true. Today, when you hear broadcasters speaking news, everybody's kind of going, really? I mean, fake news is all around us. We hear it, we see it, we're in touch with it every day. You know, Obama, whether he's really a citizen of the United States, his whole birth certificate thing, Trump, whether he colluded with the Russians or not, Obama signing an executive order that says there's no more Pledge of Allegiance allowed in public schools. There's Pope Francis endorsed Donald Trump for president. I mean, it just kind of goes on and on and on. And we hear all this stuff and we say, fake, fake, fake. I mean, would you agree? Yeah, fake. The news is just fake. The problem with fake news is that it destroys the integrity of truth. When you hear a bunch of lies, it makes you wonder what is true. When somebody does nothing but lie to you, then you wonder, is there anything that person says that's true? This is one of the reasons in a court of law that lawyers will go to great extremes to try to prove that somebody lied. Because if they lied in the past, then can we trust what you're saying now? It causes us to turn into a bunch of cynics. And sadly, it's driven a whole bunch of people to really wonder if anything is true. We're entering into a great time of year. Spring is upon us. It's a wonderful season, new life. I mean, the daffodils are up and warmer weather, green leaves, plants, grass, flowers. But more, this is the season of the church calendar when we celebrate a spiritual new life because of the Passion. Over the last several months, we've been in the study of the book of Romans. And it's evident from that study that the salvation of the world was God's intent from literally the beginning of time. God moved powerfully throughout history to move us, to bring us to the Messiah. And the Messiah came. 2,000 years ago, Jesus appeared. We just celebrated his birth back in December. He came, he lived, he died for our sins. He was buried and he was raised on the third death to life. We as a church, we do not worship a dead Savior. Muhammad is still in his grave. Buddha is still in his grave. But Jesus is not in his grave. Jesus is alive. Come on, church. He's alive. We have reason to rejoice today. And as he was resurrected from the dead, that resurrection gives us hope that we too will have a new life again. Here we are 2,000 years later celebrating those events that happened in the city of Jerusalem. And it's interesting. There are any number of people in our country, in our neighborhoods, in our world, that don't hold any of the events of the Passion in esteem. They don't believe that it really happened. They don't believe in the historicity of the Bible. They don't believe that the Bible has any credibility. They teach that it's nothing but a bunch of myths and legends, made up stories to try to sway people's thinking. It's nothing but a bunch of fake news. The problem is they're absolutely wrong. The biblical text has undergone the most rigorous of scrutiny. It's been under huge amounts of examination and has been found to have integrity. And what that means is you can trust it. It's true. It's real. It's supported by not only what's written here, it's supported by secular historians. Did you know that? The Bible is not the only place that talks about the events that are recorded in the pages of Scripture. Secular history records it too. In fact, when we come to the Passion Week, there were Jewish historians and Roman historians that wrote about all these things. Josephus, Pliny, Tacitus. They all wrote it down. Archaeology has dug up and has proved that the things that are written about in the Bible are exactly what happened. In short, and I want you to write this down, the Bible's recounting of history is both true and accurate. And what that means is simply this: the Passion is not fake news. You can trust the Bible. You can trust the biblical narrative. You can trust the story. Over the next 3 weeks, we're going to look at three specific parts of the Passion narrative. 2 weeks from today, obviously, we're going to talk about the resurrection. Did it really happen? There's a whole lot of people that are saying it didn't happen. It's just a bunch of trumped up lies. Next week, we're going to talk about his death, his crucifixion. Did it really happen? Did he really die? And the answer is absolutely it did. Today, we're talking about his arrests and trials, what Jesus went through leading up to his crucifixion. So what I want you to do is strap in, because we got a lot of material we're going to cover really fast. Get out that page of notes, write some things down, and let's begin with this. Let's begin with the setup. What I want to do is I want to take you to the Garden of Gethsemane. The ugly events of this 12-hour period that was the Passion began in the Garden of Gethsemane. And to help you here, what I want to do is put up a map of the area. And as you're looking at this map, what I want you to know is the top is north. So you're looking north. And in our purview here, if you're just looking straight through the stage, straight through me, you're looking north. So the top of this map is north. And as you're looking at the map, the red line, the red line that's kind of moving all the way through this left half of the picture, this would be the city of Jerusalem. And then up on the kind of the right side of that, where the blue circle is now, that would have been the temple court. And the temple court, right in the middle, you can see that kind of the red outline right in the middle. The temple structure itself was right in the middle. There's courtyards, courts of the Gentiles, courts of the women, courts of the Jews, places that only the priests could go. And so it's all inside this structure. And so this is the temple. Now, just to the east of this is the Kidron Valley. And what I want you to know is that Jerusalem is up in the hills. The Dead Sea is like 1,300 feet below sea level. Jerusalem is several hundred feet above sea level. This is a mountainous area, a mountainous region. So it goes up and down a lot. And that would be the Kidron Valley. I've got a picture here kind of looking from what would be the north and then looking down south and east. And up kind of on the right side, you can see this wall area. That would be the old wall of that temple court that you're looking at. You're looking in this picture kind of south and east, and this is the Kidron Valley. You can see it's up and down. Where the picture is taken is kind of like moving onto the Mount of Olives, if you've heard of that phrase, which you probably have. So this is the Kidron Valley. Now, the Garden of Gethsemane was across the Kidron Valley. It's down through the valley, then up. And it's up in this right-hand side, probably an olive grove. It's located kind of just straight east of the temple courts here. And this is the place we're talking about, the Kidron Valley. Now, the Garden of Gethsemane was the place that Jesus is going to end up. But what you need to know is before he was here, he was in the old city of Jerusalem. He was in the upper room. And we read about this where the disciples were getting ready to partake of the Passover feast. And they were there. They took the feast. Jesus instituted the Lord's Supper. He predicted that Peter was going to deny. He predicted that Judas was going to be the one that would turn him in and turn against him. He taught them, John 14 through 16. There was this big high priestly prayer that came on, and that's John 17. And then after the disciples had been through all of these things, then they sang a hymn, and they left the upper room, and they started their trek from the upper room up into Gethsemane. Now, the upper room is probably over here on the southeast corner of the city. Southwest corner of the city. That's where most people see it. So the disciples trek through the city. They trek down through an eastern gate, down into the Kidron Valley, across the Kidron Valley, then up on into the Garden of Gethsemane. Garden was a place that Jesus often went. Whenever he was in Jerusalem, Jesus would be inundated, overrun by the crowds. People had heard of the miracles, heard of his powerful teaching. They when they were in Jerusalem, they wanted to see him, wanted to be near him. This was a place that as a Jew, he was going to be. And so people were coming and they were looking for him. And so you can just imagine from morning until night, Jesus is being literally surrounded by crowds of people who just wanted to be near him, wanted to touch him, wanted to hear him. There were times, I'm just telling you, that can be exhausting. And there were times that he just wanted to get away. And so he would. Typically at night, he would stay in Bethany, which was like 3.5 to 4 miles. It's a trek up and over the Mount of Olives. And this is where Lazarus and Mary and Martha lived. They had a house. Jesus would get away from the city and he would stay there, probably have dinner and have a fair night's sleep. But sometimes during the day, as things would tense up, Jesus would go to this garden up on the Mount of Olives where he could get away, where he could think, where he could rest, where he could pray. And that's exactly what Jesus was heading to the garden to do, to get away, to think, to pray. The Last Supper has been had. The events of the Passion are now upon him. And so I want you to note two things. First, Jesus is here to pray. What he's doing literally is he is setting his mind and his heart. This is a point where he's going to be resolute. He's making a determination. Am I going to go through with this? He's setting his heart and his mind to be obedient to the call and to the will of God. Now, if you've read through this section of Scripture, you know that at this point, Jesus is under huge amounts of stress. Everything that he had come to earth to accomplish was now upon him. I mean, I'm sure you can relate to this in some ways. You know, way back here, you said, yeah, I'll do that. And now as the time has approached and it's time to do it, it's like, man, why did I ever say yes to this? That's where Jesus is. He said yes to this from the beginning, before there was even time. He knew that this was the plan, but that was a long way off, and now it's upon him. He's going to suffer in ways that are absolutely incomprehensible to us. And being God, Jesus knew exactly what was coming. And here's the truth. He did not want to do it. I mean, would you? Seriously, if you knew that you were facing crucifixion, if you knew that you were facing everything that was going to happen before the crucifixion, I mean, is this what you would want to go through? No, Jesus didn't want to do it. He didn't want to be crucified. And so here in the garden, he's praying. Matthew 26:39 says, he left the disciples. And he went further, deeper into this olive grove of a garden. He falls down on his face to the ground. I mean, he's like prostrate on the ground. And he's now praying, Father, if it's possible, may this cup be taken from me. Let it go away. Take it away. I want you to see it. Jesus prayed this prayer 3 times. In the matter of a half an hour, 45 minutes, or an hour, as it's going through, 3 times he's going to his Father and he's praying. Jesus did not want to do this. Find another way. There's got to be another way. Find it. But even as he's praying, Jesus is submitting. He's stating what his physical will is, his emotional will, but then he's resolving himself by saying, it's not what I want, it's what you want. Not my will, but yours. Whatever it is that you want me to do, whatever it is that you have called me to do, I will submit to. This is the path. I'm on it. I'm ready. With the resolution complete, Matthew goes on in verse 45, chapter 26, to say, when he returned to the disciples, and once again he finds them sleeping. Don't you just find that interesting? Jesus has been predicting this for at least a year and a half. That he's going to suffer, that he's going to die. This is no question that this is what's going to happen. It's upon him. Judas has gone to betray him. It's upon them. Jesus told them before they ever got to Jerusalem that I'm going to Jerusalem to die. And so you would think that they would have been up with him. They would have been concerned, stressed with him. But that's not what happened. They're asleep. He comes back, finds them asleep, says to them, are you still sleeping and resting? Look, the hour is near. And the Son of Man is being betrayed into the hands of sinners. Rise, let's go. Here comes the betrayer. And as he's speaking the words, they're turning and coming into the garden is a mob. A couple things to note. Jesus is arrested. This crowd is being led by Judas. The temple guard took Jesus into custody. And Matthew and Mark identify the group as a is a crowd carrying swords and clubs. Luke gets a little bit more specific in chapter 22, verse 52. He says the crowd consisted of chief priests, officers of the temple, and the elders. They were all led by Judas. And as Judas walks in, things happen really very quickly. Judas approaches Jesus. He takes him and he gives him a kiss. It was the sign. The one I kiss, the one I greet, he is the one that you're to grab. That's Jesus. And as soon as Judas does his deed, a melee breaks out. Peter pulls out this sword. And as he pulls out the sword, I think he's aiming to cut off the guy right in front of him, cut off his head. Somehow he misses. The guy's maybe ducking at the same time. He cuts off his ear. The guy is identified as Malchus, the servant of the high priest. And as this is going down, I mean, can you imagine being Malchus as you're watching this going, and suddenly the ear's coming off, and Malchus is probably screaming, and the crowd's starting to, this mob is starting to rise up, you know, because they see something bad happen. Jesus is calming the whole thing. He says, Peter, put away your sword. Put it away. And then he's picking up the ear off the ground, maybe dusting it off, and he's sticking it back on Malchus's head. I mean, I hope God has some of this on home video. You know what I mean? Because this is one of these moments where Peter's like, you know, and you're just like, oh, and then the ears go, ah, and then all of a sudden, whoa, it's all okay. The whole thing is calmed down, and Jesus is bound up, and he's led back to Jerusalem. The religious leaders have been working for 2 years to get rid of Jesus, and their plan's now well underway. And it led to the rest of the activities of the night. And that was trials. And when I think of the trials, the thing that runs through my brain is simply justice run amok. Over the next 10 hours, from the point of his arrest to the point where he's nailed to the cross, sometime around 11 o'clock or midnight, he's on the cross at 9 in the morning. Sometime between these 9 or 10 hours, Jesus has run through 4 trials. And yeah, I said 4, F-O-U-R, 4. 4 trials. And you think about that. Today in the United States, if we were going to have a capital case where somebody is potentially going to be executed for their crimes, this thing is going to go on for months and months and months and potentially years. And then the guy's going to be put in prison, and then it's going to go through appeal after appeal after appeal. From the time that somebody's arrested and goes through a trial to an execution, you know that can be 15, 20, 25 years. But Jesus went through 4 trials in 600 minutes. And it began with the Jews, with the Sanhedrin, the religious leaders of the day. It was a kangaroo court. They had no authority to do what they wanted to do, but they were meeting anyway. Now, if you're reading through the text, you'll quickly notice this week, and I hope you do, the passages are at the top of your notes. I hope you will read. And you'll quickly notice that there are 2 men referred to as the high priest. One's Annas and one's Caiaphas. Annas was the high priest. He's not the current high priest. Annas had that role for about 7 years, and then he had 5 sons. Those 5 sons were in that role as well, high priest. Caiaphas, who is now the high priest, is the son-in-law of Annas. So it starts with Annas, and he's being referred to as the high priest, but it's kind of like just it's a title that is given to him, you know, kind of a respect type of thing. It's like we would say of Obama or Bush or Carter, Mr. President. You held the office, and it's kind of referring to them is in a way that would give them respect. Jesus is led to Annas' house. The purpose is to find a charge. Get this, when they arrested him, they didn't have a charge. He's bound, he's imprisoned, he's shackled as if he's done something wrong, but they really don't even know what he's done wrong yet. Now, the interesting thing is they couldn't find a charge. They're at Annas' house, so they can find a charge, so they can bring him to the high priest's place, so high priest's house, so they can have this hearing, but they can't find a charge. And the reason they couldn't find one is because he's innocent. He's innocent. So this goes on for a season. Now the whole council has been called. They now have Jesus in custody, so they lead him to Caiaphas' house. And the charade begins. Matthew 26, 59 says, the chief priests, the whole Sanhedrin were looking for false evidence. Look at this. They're looking for false evidence against Jesus so that they could put him to death. Mark 14:56 says many testified falsely against him, but their statements did not agree. False witnesses bringing false evidence. What a court of law. And in the Jewish system, where Jesus is standing is like the highest court in Israel. This would be like the United States Supreme Court. Can you imagine the United States Supreme Court suborning perjury? That this is what they want to hear. Bring in all the false witnesses. Let them bring false. No, it really, what should have happened is, according to law, is that anybody's bringing false evidence has perjured themselves. And in the Jewish system, according to God's law, these people were worthy of whatever punishment was potentially going to be on the person that they're accusing. It's a travesty. The whole thing is unraveling. And as it's unraveling, a couple of guys come forward. Matthew chapter 26, 60, the second part of the verse, it says, finally two men came forward and they declared, this fellow said, I'm able to destroy the temple of God and I'm able to rebuild it in 3 days. If you've read the Gospels, you know Jesus did say this. Jesus was not talking about the physical temple, like he's out to destroy Judaism, like, you know, I'm going to bring in my battering ram, like, you know, I can destroy it and then build it all up. I mean, it took years and years and years to rebuild the temple. Jesus wasn't talking about the physical temple, he's talking about his body, and everybody knew that. You destroy my body, you kill me, I'll rise in 3 days. In fact, the day that he was speaking of was upon him right now. They're going to witness his prophetic statement coming to fulfillment right before their very eyes. How this was any kind of threat against them or Judaism is beyond me. But this became the claim they decided to focus in on. So Caiaphas stood up and asked Jesus, are you not going to answer these guys? Why is this testimony? What is this testimony that these men are bringing against you? Speak up, speak up. Like it would have done any good. What they're saying has been completely twisted out of context. Jesus is like shaking his head. It's not even worthy of a response. So his determination is to be silent. So Caiaphas got more pointed. Matthew 26, 63 says, I charge you under oath by the living God, tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God. Tell us if it's true. Finally, some truth. Because this is exactly who Jesus was. And now that it's out on the table, Jesus is going to answer the truth. And to this point, he says, Matthew 26, 64, yes, it is as you say, but I say to all of you, in the future you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven. Ah, yeah, woo, yeah, that's going to be a day. I hope I'm alive for that, don't you? I hope I'm alive for that second coming. I hope it's going to happen in my lifetime. But anyway, at this point, Caiaphas, this is it. Caiaphas jumps up. He's ripping his robe, his high priestly robe, and he's shouting blasphemy. You're claiming to be God. That's blasphemous. And so he turns to the other members of the council, Matthew 26, 66, and he says, what do you think? And they all respond by saying, he is worthy of death. Kill him. And with that, trial's over. The jury's made its decision, and so they take him off to Pilate's house. And I've labeled this second trial as a joke. Pilate's court was a joke. I mean, there's just really no other way to see it. Pilate's referred to in the Bible as the governor or the procurator of Palestine. Palestine was under the direct control, authority of the Roman Empire, the Emperor of Rome. Emperors couldn't oversee like this. So what they did is they brought in people that they put into places in regions that would be the governor or the procurator of an area, and they would work under the authority of Rome at the emperor's behest. Pilate had been given authority over Palestine. It's his job to keep the peace for the Roman Empire in this region. Failure to do so would have dire consequences. You didn't do what the Roman Emperor wanted you to do, you're probably going to die for it. And you have to know that Pilate had an unbelievably tough job. The Jews believed that nobody should be ruling over them. God is our ruler. God should be our king. We should have no earthly king. That's just how it should be. Not even Caesar. So they were in a constant state of rebellion against Rome. If you think about it, it put Pilate in a constant state of trouble with the authorities back in Rome, because this whole place is constantly just simmering, getting ready to explode. Word on the street was that Pilate was at the end of his rope with Rome, that one more revolt, one more bad thing going down, one more explosion, Pilate would be recalled to Rome and would be executed. The Jewish leadership knew they had Pilate over a barrel, and they were going to use it all to their favor. And with the crowd at his gates now, early in the morning, probably about 6 as the sun is coming up, the exchange started. And honestly, it was testy. John 18, verse 29 records, Pilate came out to them and asked, "What charges are you bringing against this guy? You just woke me up. What do you want?" Verse 30, they respond by saying, "If he were not a criminal, we would not have handed him over to you." Now, don't miss this. Just a half an hour earlier, they had accused Jesus of blasphemy, which according to Jewish law meant execute. The Jews have already given up on the charge that they've now arrested him to bring him to Pilate to. They knew Rome doesn't care about blasphemy of the Jewish God. So basically what these guys are saying to Pilate is, "We want him dead. Do what we want." It's a threat. Now, Pilate's almost laughing at this moment. He says, "You got a law. Go judge him by your own law." And Pilate starts to turn around and go away. So they jumped at that moment to something that Rome would be interested in. Again, their whole plan has already unraveled. And here they are now claiming that Jesus is seditious. Luke chapter 23, 2, they began to accuse Jesus, saying, "We have found this man subverting our nation. He opposes payments to taxes to Caesar, and he claims to be Christ, a king." It's all a lie. In fact, Jesus may have been the only Jew not to oppose Caesar and not to want to destroy Rome. In fact, just a couple of days earlier, as they're trying to set him up, in this last week of all these questions that they're bringing to him, that they're looking for something to charge him with, they asked if they should be giving Caesar money. And Jesus said, "Yeah, you should give Caesar what is Caesar's. If you owe taxes, pay taxes. Submit to the governing authorities." We're going to get to that in Romans chapter 13 in a few weeks. Jesus wasn't subversive. And the point here is that he's completely innocent. He was not leading a rebellion against Rome. Pilate could see this was going nowhere. So the mob is just going to go crazy. So he invites Jesus into his home. You can read about this in John 18. There's an interaction that goes between Pilate and Jesus. And he just kind of pushes Jesus aside. Jesus is speaking about what truth is. Pilate is not interested in truth. He just kind of scoffs. I mean, what he sees is a guy that's completely innocent and maybe a little bit crazy. Some guy who thinks he's God is really not a threat. He's maybe, you know, a little bit of schizophrenic, but that's about it. So Pilate comes out, makes his appearance again before the Jewish leadership. And in John 18:38, he says, "I find no basis of a charge against him." In other words, he's innocent. Now, why is Pilate's court a joke? Why did I say that this is a joke? Because of right here, Pilate has pronounced Jesus innocent. And if you're innocent, you should go free. I mean, that should have been the end of it right there. Innocent, free. Unchain him, send him on his way. So what did Pilate do? Well, he didn't do that. And that's the point. What he tried to do is pass the buck. And he passed the buck by sending him to Herod. Now, as soon as Pilate says, "I find no basis of a charge against this man," Jewish leadership, I mean, they just went nuts. In Luke 23:5, they start yelling. "He stirs up the people all over Judea by his teaching. He started in Galilee and he's come all the way here." And so when Pilate heard the word Galilee, his ears perk up. Because he's not the procurator of Galilee. That's way north, up by the Sea of Galilee. And the guy that's in charge up there is named Herod. You've probably read about him. And Herod just happens to be in Jerusalem for the Passover feast. And so Pilate's thinking, if he's from Galilee, then we ought to send him to where he's from, and we ought to let Herod take care of this. And it just happens that Herod's just up the street. It is palace up the street. And so he remands Jesus to Herod. And when Jesus arrived at Herod's house, Herod's interest is suddenly piqued. He's looking at this going, man, I want to hear about this. Luke 23 says, when he saw Jesus, he was greatly pleased. For a long time, he had been wanting to see him. From what he had heard about him, he hoped to see him perform some miracles. I mean, right off the bat, you get the feeling that this isn't going to be any kind of court of law. I mean, Herod wants to be entertained. Herod's looking for a dog and pony show. So Jesus is invited in. And when he comes in, all the Jewish leadership come in with him. And these guys are just vehement. I mean, they're screaming and yelling. They're accusing Jesus. And Jesus' response to all of it? Silence. What good is it going to do to argue against craziness? That just egged Herod and his soldiers on. So in Luke 23:11, Herod and his soldiers start jumping into the fray, and now they're ridiculing and mocking Jesus. That didn't work either. Jesus just remains silent. And you get the picture that this whole thing lasted about 3 or 4 minutes. Herod that quickly is bored. And Luke tells us that they dressed Jesus up in a robe and they sent him back to Pilate. So we've had the Sanhedrin meeting, we've had Pilate, now we've had Herod. That brings us to this fourth trial back in front of Pilate. And Pilate at this moment is going to completely fail at his job. Just imagine Pilate's chagrin when suddenly the bound up Jesus is being led back into his presence. He thought he had cleverly solved the problem by pushing him off to Herod. I've got him off his plate, but now Jesus is back again, and the Jewish leaders are not about to let it go. They want Jesus dead. They want Jesus dead now. They're going to do whatever they need to do. So instead of calming things down, they were actually ratcheting it up to another level. And this is when Pilate gets a bright idea. He comes up with another possible solution to get himself out of this mess, because remember, he has pronounced Jesus is innocent. And his great idea is a guy by the name of Barabbas. Now, it just happens to be that at this season of the year, it was the custom of the Roman governor, Matthew 27 tells us, to set a prisoner free. This would be a Jewish prisoner in the Roman dungeons, to set somebody free. It's a diplomatic gesture. We're trying to keep the peace. We're trying to make you happy. We're releasing somebody who's important to you. And so Pilate comes up with kind of a sly idea here. The most notorious prisoner in their system, in the Roman dungeon in Jerusalem, is a guy by the name of Barabbas. We learn that he is an insurrector of Rome, and he's also a murderer. In other words, Barabbas was a bad mamma jamma. This is the kind of guy that you want in prison. Pilate's ploy is to offer the Jews a choice. You can have Barabbas, the guy who's an insurrectionist, a traitor, and he's a murderer, or you can have the meek and mild Jesus, who really is maybe a little bit crazy, but he hasn't done anything wrong. What do you think? What do you think? Pilate was sure that nobody would pick Barabbas. That would be crazy. Jesus was the easy choice. The problem solved, I can go have breakfast. The problem wasn't solved. Matthew 27:20. The chief priests and elders had persuaded the crowd to ask for Barabbas. So now we're chanting, we want Barabbas. I mean, Pilate cannot believe what he's hearing. And that's when Pilate made a horrible mistake. Instead of being a man, instead of being a leader, instead of being a judge, instead of being just, instead of being fair, instead of saying what is right, he asked the crowd, well, then what should I do? Matthew 27:22, what should I do then with Jesus, who's called the Christ, who's called the Messiah? What should I do? And the crowd answers, you should kill him. Crucify him. Now, Pilate's now over a barrel. He knew that Jesus was innocent. He said so 3 times by now. He's pleading with the people. Why? What crime has he committed, he's asking in Matthew 27:23. What has he done? And they're just shouting. We're not listening to any reason. The crowd is now shouting. I mean, you got this. This has turned into a mob. Crucify him! Crucify him! Reason had left a long time ago. It led to one more ploy by Pilate, and that would be to flog Jesus. Let the beating of this man satisfy their emotion. Honestly, friends, I don't think that any of us really can understand what this was. The whip used for the flogging was a short wooden handle, probably wrapped with leather. Coming out of that would be nine thongs. So it would be called a cat of nine tails. I mean the handle's maybe this long, you know. I mean, the whole thing is probably at the end of these thongs, you would tie in pieces of sharpened bone or metal, rock. They would take a prisoner, they would tie him to a pole, his wrists would be tied, he would be pulled up so that he would almost be dangling, so he would be up on his toes. Basically, the whole point was to get his back as tight as possible. And then one, maybe two guys would start the process, standing on each side. That whip would come in, and since there were sharp objects on it, it would hit and it would stick, and then they would rip down. For a Roman, you could be lashed 40 times. If you were a Roman citizen, it was 40, and they would always do 40 minus one in case they lost count someplace. So you get 39 of these lashes. When you were not a Roman citizen, anything goes. They would hit you as many times as they wanted to. The damage was huge. Muscles were lacerated. Veins and arteries were ripped open. It wasn't uncommon for kidneys, the spleen, other organs to be exposed. By the time the Romans were done with the flogging, many people died. We don't know the condition of Jesus after this horrible trauma, but you have to think he was in bad shape. The loss of blood, the body trauma, would have left him hardly able to stand, most likely in shock, hardly recognizable. Your body starts puffing up. He's all swollen up. And remember, by this time, he's already been beaten by the Jews. Every time he said something they didn't want, they hit him. He's been beaten up. Now he's been flogged. His body would have been a lacerated, swollen, bloody mess. And then the soldiers went further. John 19, 2 and 3 says, they twisted together a crown of thorns. They put it on his head. They clothed him in a purple robe. And they went up to him again and again, saying, "Hail, King of the Jews," and they struck him in the face. Don't see this as a slap. You see this as a fist. We're now talking knocking out teeth, breaking his nose, concussions. And that's when Pilate brings him back out to Jesus, this beat up, swollen, bloodied, hardly able to stand man. John chapter 19, 5 says he brings him before the crowd in his purple robe, and Pilate says, "Here's the man. Behold the man." Pilate was looking for sympathy. He wanted to release Jesus. He's like saying, "What harm can he possibly do to you? Look at him." He's hoping enough is enough. Can't y'all just let it go? But the crazed crowd wouldn't stop. They're pushing the envelope. As soon, John 19:6, as soon as the chief priests and their officials saw Jesus, "Behold the man," now they're yelling again, "Crucify him." I mean, we're coming into a frenzied craze. And this is when Pilate completely bailed. He knew Jesus was innocent, but he was more interested in saving his own neck from what might happen to him in Rome. So he took the last cowardly step. He brings out a basin of water and he washes his hands. And he says, "I'm innocent of this man's blood. I'm innocent. I'm going to give you what you want, but I am innocent of it." And the crowd shouts back, Matthew 27, 25. "Well, that's fine. You let his blood be on our heads. We'll take it. And not only on our heads, on our children's too." And with that, the legal hearings were over. Jesus was remanded into the hands of the Roman soldiers. The Roman trials had started at about 6 in the morning. Pilate, Herod, Pilate, flogging. In 180 minutes, he's been through 3 trials. He's been found innocent 3 times by Pilate. At 9 o'clock, he's going to be on the cross. So in less than 3 hours, he's endured all of this, including carrying his cross to the place of execution. An execution is going to be carried out now. Leads to one last thought, and it's just the trouble of the whole situation. Because here's the deal, friends, it was all a legal sham. Seriously, and this is not fake news. There was nothing legal about any of this. The arrest and Jewish trials were all illegal according to Jewish law. When you look at Jewish law and understand it, it's all illegal. Several laws from the Mishnah were just shattered. Jesus was arrested without a charge. It should have never happened. The only charge against him was manufactured. And when it got to the real trial, they didn't even use that. I mean, it didn't even come into play. It was illegal, according to the Mishnah, for the Sanhedrin to meet at night, meet on the eve before Passover, or to meet at the high priest's house. Every one of these guys, the elders, the teachers of the law, you know they knew this, and all three of those laws were broken. When they were interrogating him and they didn't get what they want, they beat him. A death sentence required a second hearing. According to Jewish law, you can't just meet and then you needed to let everybody go home and stew on this for a day or two or four, have all the evidence presented, and then go home so that the people that are going to, the religious leaders that are going to make the judgment would come back 4 or 5 days later after they've thought about it, if they've reasoned it through before they would pass a judgment. Not now. This is going to happen like now. What, Caiaphas, blasphemy, what do y'all say? He's guilty, let him die. Contradicting witnesses should have been thrown out. Not only that, Deuteronomy 19, 16 through 19 says that the punishment that they were accusing, the crime they were accusing him of, if he was innocent of it, then they should have been receiving that same punishment. This is a capital offense. If you're innocent, then we should die. And it goes on and on and on. According to Jewish law, it was a sham. In the Roman trial, all I can say is it was ramrodded through by a paranoid Roman governor. Three times in the proceedings, you count them as you read this week, three times Pilate says, this guy's innocent. I find no basis for the charge. But the man, Pilate, was just too weak to do his job, to stand up for what was right, to protect the innocent. Pilate was more concerned with his own neck. And it all spells injustice. And it's not fake news. None of it should have happened. It was a travesty. And the interesting thing, it could have all been stopped. Back in the Garden of Gethsemane, as Jesus was telling Peter to put the sword away, as the mob was coming to arrest him, put the sword away, he says to the disciples, look, Matthew 26, 53, do you think I cannot call on my Father and he will at once put at my disposal more than 12 legions of angels? I'm telling you guys, thousands and thousands of angels could have poured into this garden right now and they could have just dropped everybody dead. So why wasn't it stopped? Jesus goes on in verse 54. But how then would the scriptures be fulfilled that said that it must happen this way? It could have been stopped, but it wasn't, because this is what needed to happen. This was the plan of God. If salvation was going to come to humankind, then someone had to die in humankind's place. And the buck stopped with Jesus, who was resolved to what the Father wanted him to do, and he submitted to it. And the question, especially as we've come through Romans chapters 9, 10, and 11, the question is, so did God force these people to do this thing? And the answer is no. God elected to use the evil of these people to accomplish his will. We have a great God. God's will was not to turn these people's hearts into evilness, but he knew where they were and he knew what they would do, and he used it for the purpose of his kingdom. So how should we respond? You know, the question is, what will you do with Jesus? Was this whole thing just made up? Is this book really not true? The events, just a fabrication? I mean, if so, throw it out and walk out. Really, literally, walk out. But if it is true, the only response really is to do what Thomas did in the upper room after the resurrection. That's to bow and say, my Lord and my God. If it's true, then sit up, friends. Take notice. Could I get you to bow your heads? Would you do that? And I can speak with authority. I've done the reading, I've done the research, I've done the study. The events are true, they did happen. Jesus was unjustly charged and he was sent to a death. And God allowed it to happen because somebody needed to die in my place if I was going to be saved. My question is, have you accepted it? Have you submitted to it? Have you joined Thomas in saying, my Lord, my God? Father, I just pray that in the stillness of this moment, you'll cause our hearts and our minds to move straight to you, to marvel at the gift of your grace, the gift of your love, to marvel at what Jesus was willing to endure for me, for us, for the world. And Father, we're grateful for it. Help us to not walk passively through these next few days as we move to Easter. Father, help us to take it all in, to take in the injustice, to take in the cross, to take in the suffering, to take in the death, to take in the pain that you endured for us. And Father, help us to marvel at it. But even more, Father, help us to accept it as your gift of grace on our behalf. And we lift it up in the name of the one who made it possible, and that would be Jesus. And God's people said,